the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest this week is Paul Horn from PFS Group. He's a certified financial planner. And the subject of conversation, cash flow and its importance in retirement. We're talking, of course, not a constricted cash flow, but a healthy cash flow. You know, we've reported and discussed on our programs many times how the retirement paradigm has radically changed for baby boomers. Every month there seems to be a new story or a survey documenting how retirement is changing for boomers to living longer to working longer. But one issue stands out, and that is that boomers are less secure than their parents. What's interesting is that during their lifetimes, it turned out that whereas their parents, the World War II generation, one person could support a family, it took two people during the lifetimes of the boomers to do that. That's probably traceable to inflation. But there are other reasons, and what that means is they're less secure than their parents. Let's face it, the investment environment is much more volatile right now and less favorable. Medical costs are rising. They were rising out of proportion to inflationary costs even before Obamacare came along, and now as a result of Obamacare, they're rising even more, and we're living longer. So theoretically, not only are the costs rising, but you're going to need to make those costs over a longer period of time. So many individuals today worry about outliving your assets, not to mention the fact that among baby boomers and succeeding generations, the amount of savings that people have had has been dwindling. So hopefully today's show is going to help alleviate some of the stress and worry in how you plan to get ready for your retirement.
You know, it's amazing, John, because there have been a number of studies and books out that show that working longer tends to extend our life. And there's a couple of books. Hopefully we'll get some of the authors here on the program. But one that came out in 2005. It was by Ken Dykewald. He's author of The Age of Power, How the 21st Century Will Be Ruled by the Old. And he's referring here to the traditional retirement as an intellectual wasteline. He said, we're convincing ourselves that leading a productive, useful life by working as long as possible is really the key to longevity. And we've seen a number of studies. In fact, there was one that just came out recently in the Wall Street Journal that talked about those that worked longer. It was amazing. I was reading an article yesterday about, you know, the events that were taking place in China. One of the people they interviewed was the former head of AIG, who's 90 years old and starting all over again with another insurance company. So here he is, and 90 years old, starting another business after, you know, what he went through with AIG. And it's amazing, John, because I was watching a program the other night, Strange Inheritances, and I guess the grandfather that had left this inheritance had been at some kind of meet or someplace, and he met Colonel Sanders, who tried to talk him into investing in this idea of fried chicken. So imagine had you got in early on Kentucky Fried Chicken. But anyway, the fact remains there's a new paradigm on retirement today. And that includes, as we have discussed on this program numerous times, actually retiring later. Or if you are retired, working part-time or some form of work in retirement. Part of it may be out of necessity to supplement your income, and part of it out of just, quite honestly, feeling productive and connected. So there are a number of reasons why this paradigm has changed, but it seems like we're going more back to, as Dykewald talks about in his book, more to sort of the semi-working or extended working period of our lives, and that retirement is going to look much, much different. Those that will retire will be either individuals that just have so much money they're able to do it, or it might be for health reasons.
So we know we're living longer. Healthcare costs are going up, and investment returns on safe assets, I guess we could declare them right now as being non-existent. And yet, despite all of this and the radical change in this type of an environment, the vast majority of Americans don't have a plan. So if there's one thing we want to stress today, if you don't have a plan, Well, first of all, it's never too late to start one now, either before you retire or if you are now retired. Well, don't fool yourself and that group that outlives their assets and are in a constant state of worry over the markets and their lifestyle. You can do a plan right now and structure where you're headed.
You know, this is also a paradigm shift for our industry because the vast majority of people with accumulated wealth today are the boomers through their 401k programs that are heading into retirement. But John, most of our industry is focused on the accumulation of assets, basically the accumulation phase of your life when you were working, putting money aside for that retirement date. The focus really changes when you retire because it really goes from accumulation to what some would call decumulation. It is a much more encompassing strategy, and the strategies at this stage require significantly more than, let's say, just withdrawing funds. It's all about wealth preservation because you don't want to lose what you have, and the creation of income streams from existing assets. And there has to be a strategy that focuses on longevity and also taking care of increased medical costs, which go along hand in hand with longer lifespans.
So basically, we have a greater focus on risk management and the nature of the income streams. Now, what does that mean for retirement portfolios versus pre-retirement portfolios? What are the changes that occur at retirement?
Well, usually, I mean, when you think about saving for retirement, you're putting money in a 401k program. You're probably putting that money into some kind of, you know, stock funds or something that has more growth because you're not relying on your assets while you're working. You have a job that covers your expenses. At retirement, conventional portfolios will need to be revised to accommodate basically three financial needs: the need for income, also the need for growth, because you're living longer. You're going to need those assets to take care of you over a longer period of time. So you're either going to have those assets grow or the income grow or both. And also for savings, the portfolio should also be tax efficient. You don't want to be paying high taxes like you did when you work. And also it has to provide a hedge against inflation and have the ability to provide for those planned and what we sometimes call unplanned events, or what we call personal black swans. All of a sudden illness, or, you know, it could be a situation where maybe one spouse is retired, the other one's still working, providing the bulk of the income, and all of a sudden that spouse gets laid off. We saw a lot of this happen in 2007 and 2008 and 9 as a result of the financial crisis. A lot of people that worked in the mortgage industry, construction industry, and all the ancillary type of services, a lot of people lost their jobs and weren't planning on that because we were in a boom. Well, the boom ended. And all of a sudden, people were faced with moving into a retirement space when they had not planned on it, or at least had planned for working over a longer period of time.
All right, so the portfolio that you're going to put together in retirement is going to be different than the one you had before you retired. I'm assuming there's some kind of a transformation or transition type of process here.
Well, I mean, most definitely. I mean, your priorities are going to change because you need to develop an income stream that will last as long as, let's say, the individual's lifespan. And in addition, outpaces the rate of inflation, especially, John, as we're seeing as a result of Obamacare, healthcare inflation that threatens to slowly but surely rot your nest egg. And it's similar to when you think about Maslow's hierarchy of human needs. There's basically a hierarchy that has been evolved in, let's say, the retirement planning process, but this one has to do with money. And instead of, let's say, psychological needs, just substitute the word money. And what you do is design an income stream that lasts for your lifetime. And just like Maslow taught that human beings are motivated by unmet needs, lower needs need to be satisfied first before the higher needs can be addressed. And sometimes people get those confused. And a good example, there are basically, if you take a look at Maslow's hierarchy, well, just let's translate it into money. There is the survival money that's at the bottom. You got to take care of those basic needs. Then we have what we call safety money freedom money. That's the ability to do those kind of things you want to do, travel, take trips, hobbies. There's gift money if you want to make bequests, and dream money, buying that vacation home, buying that fishing boat, or buying that motor home, or whatever it is. And, you know, it's a hierarchy of needs, but unless you meet that very survival need in Maslow's hierarchy, or what we call survival money, that's what keeps people really worrying a lot, because they're saying, gosh, I don't know, you know, what our expenses are going to be. I don't know what our sources of income to cover those expenses. And it creates a lot of anxiety.
You know, I remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs from psychology. Everybody does. But since we're talking about money here and using this is more of an analogy to Maslow's needs of human life, why don't you explain them step by step?
Well, let's take a look at what we call survival money. And that's money to make ends meet. Now, for everybody, it's a little bit different. I mean, how much do you need simply to survive each month? Is it $2,000, $3,000, $5,000, $7,000? Whatever that number is. But if you strip away all the frills and thrills and pay only the bills of survival, that means what does it cost to pay your rent, your utilities, food costs? Most people have never taken the time to answer this most basic financial question of all. What is the cost of survival? The money needed to pay for basic necessities is what we call in retirement planning survival income. Now, if you have enough to cover that, then you can move on to what we call, let's say, safety. Money needed to meet life's unexpected turns. How many of events have happened in your life that have shown up unexpectedly? It could be medical cost. Maybe you're helping one of your children. Something happens to the car. Something breaks down in the house. What if everything doesn't work out as you hope and imagine it will? I don't know very many people that can have a plan and everything happens exactly the way you planned it your entire life. Life just doesn't work out that way. In life, the one thing that we can predict with great assurance is that things rarely go exactly as planned. Businesses face this all the time. I mean, we're surrounded by risk, physical risk related to health, financial, circumstantial, and relational. Financial risk exists almost in every category of our lives. I mean, look at the financial risk associated with, for example, a divorce, a path that hastens financial ruin and is guaranteed to cut your assets in half and diminish your saving capacity. There was a study done. In fact, it was one of the studies that we covered, John, here on the program here in the last couple of weeks that talked about what happens with divorce and how that can change retirement plans. And a leading risk in the minds of individuals approaching retirement is the risk we've talked about so often here of outliving your money. Other key risks are health, paying for health care, investment risk, loss of income, financial needs with the family. So as much as possible, you need to have some safety cushion in there to handle those unexpected needs. Now, if you can handle all that and you have, let's say, additional assets, then you get to what we call freedom income. That's the money needed to do the things that bring you enjoyment and fulfillment in life. Think about, let's say, the cost of activities, indulgences that bring pleasure and relaxation in your life. Some people engage in low-cost relaxation. Maybe they play golf, they walk, they exercise. Others prefer higher-priced activities, you know, joining a golf club, travel, adventure, personal growth, education. Personal hobbies, depending on what they are, can be quite expensive. Then once you pass through those, you get to really the top of Maslow's hierarchy. That's called gifts and dream money. Now, gift money is for people and causes that deserve your help. You may want to help a charity. Maybe it's helping individual family members or contributions to a worthwhile foundation or a cause. And then also at the very top is what we call dream income. That's money for things that you dreamed of being and doing or having. Maybe you always wanted to have that big luxury diesel motorhome, sailboat, or travel around the world. But these are the things that when there's just surplus money and income, you know, obviously, the more developed, the more assets, the more sources of income, the higher up the Maslow income retirement pyramid that you go.
Well, you know, this seems very, very similar to what you do in coming up with a budget plan, because you've always talked about doing a budget plan and you follow this hierarchy of financial needs, shall we say, where you break out the budget to, first of all, basic needs. Then above that, once your basic needs are taken care of on a regular basis, your bucket list, things that you really want to get done before you pass away, and then a wish list, things that maybe are expendable if you can't afford to do it. So you're stacking them in a hierarchical order as well, the priorities on the budget.
Yeah, it's very much the same concept. You basically strip away the budget and you get at really what does it cost to live? And I mean, this is so basic, John, but very few people do this. I mean, everybody, you know, may say, hey, I spend $7,000 a month or $5,000 a month, whatever your budget is. But really break that $5,000 or $7,000 a month. What does that really include? Is that really what it costs to live? Do you factor in, for example, replacement of automobiles? Do you factor in, you know, repairs, maintenance, things that all of a sudden throw you for a loop when they occur? But it gets at what are the basic numbers. And once you know that number, you can design what we call the basic income bucket to meet those needs. Now, it could be made up of several sources. If you're fortunate enough, it might be a pension. It could be Social Security. It might be an immediate annuity. It could be an individual bond portfolio. The size and the percentage of this bucket, and this is why we don't like to get what we call these cookie cutter plans, because you know, you're saying, okay, you're age 65 or age 60, X percent in bonds, X percent of this, really doesn't take into account your individual situation. The size of this bucket and the percentage really depends on the size of your total assets and really your own personal expenses. But when you do this, this way the client knows the purpose and the need of that bucket and the role it plays in meeting those retirement needs on the Maslow financial hierarchy. So in that way, you don't panic when the news media really fans the flames of a crisis. You know your Social Security check's coming in, your immediate annuity check, your pension check, your bond income is coming in. You don't worry. Your lifestyle is not going to change by the current crisis du jour on the evening news. So that's the first step in any kind of plan of finding that kind of sleep at night tranquility that you get knowing that your lifestyle is not going to be disrupted by any of these events.
Okay, so assuming we've done that, what comes next? Assuming that you have, you know, assets or pensions to meet those needs, then what follows from that?
Well, then, you know, once you've covered your basic expenses, then you look at the rest of the portfolio and design different portfolio buckets that are going to produce the income needed to do the things that bring you enjoyment or fulfillment in life. Things like it could be travel, golf, adventure, personal growth, education. I know one individual that went back and he never completed college. And it was only after he retired, they said, Dr. Arnn, I'm going to go back. And he actually went back to school and got his bachelor's degree. So that was one of his priority or on his bucket list of sort of self-fulfillment. And usually in this category, we often use common stocks and what I call blue chip dividend stocks, which we talk often in this segment of the program, because dividends are more secure, especially blue chip companies that have a long history of raising those dividends every year. They provide the freedom money as well as the inflation hedge to take care of those future rises in the cost of living. I mean, just take a look at what you're spending today and take a look at your checkbook in terms of what it cost you to live 10, 15, or 20 years ago. And also take a look at, as you age, some of those bigger medical bills that you may be facing down the road. This is the income stream that will pay for those things like travel, golf, hobbies, or things you want to do with your new free time, not to mention the fact that down the road, with longevity, those future medical costs that are inevitable.
You know, I understand the concept of dividend stocks and the increasing income stream and inflation protection, which is obvious because inflation is going to be with us for quite some time to come. You know, people are always concerned about the worry of a bear market, some kind of crash, because we had something back in 2007-8. And we've discussed this on our weekend show, which is why so many investors, for example, went into cash or bonds and just sat there even during a bull market. It's sort of like saying, well, I had a car accident at one time, and if I get into a car again, I might have another accident. And so I'll just not drive and I won't ride in cars. Well, it doesn't work that way. You know, it's one thing to reasonably avoiding risk, but why do you think this accounts for this kind of risk behavior and avoidance to the level that we have seen it?
I think there's probably several reasons. I don't think it's just one. And one is most investors don't have a plan, John, so they don't understand the role of different asset classes, different buckets in your portfolio, the purpose of that bucket. You know, you might have a laddered bond portfolio or immediate annuity combined with Social Security or pension that takes care of your basic living expenses. And then if you take a look at those, what we call freedom kind of expenses, you know, the extras, the travel, the golf, then they understand the role that a stock portfolio may play. But the different asset buckets in their portfolio, it's really important that you understand there's a reason that that asset exists. There's a specific purpose it is trying to meet in your life. So if your basic needs are met, then you're less likely to panic if you know the role that stocks play in your portfolio. Is, look, this is going to give that freedom money. This is going to give you your inflation hedge. This is there to take care of income. And I think another reason, John, is the myth that is developed with investors that, oh, if the stock market's down, that means my income's down. That's not true. You know, you may own Coca-Cola, and Coca-Cola may go down, or Exxon or Johnson & Johnson, but the dividend doesn't change. In fact, during the crisis years, the dividend actually goes up. So people associate a crash with the loss of income when you really don't have a loss of income if you have good dividend-paying aristocrat stocks, stocks with a strong balance sheet, a history of paying dividends over a long period of time. The stock price may be down, but the important thing is the income doesn't change, and actually it goes up, as we'll illustrate in a case study. And I think the other thing is a new industry. I call it the gloom and doom or the fear industry, where people are, you know, there's websites, there's podcasts, there's newsletters that just keep people agitated in a constant state of fear. I mean, how many times have you heard predictions of the dollar crash, the stock market crash, all the gloom and doom, the end of the United States, all of these things that you've heard for the last 5 or 6 years, none of them have ever materialized. That doesn't stop the industry from selling it to people, and it's a big industry today.
You've illustrated this point in the past with particular case study examples of, say, for example, a portfolio put together at the beginning of a financial crisis. Let's do this one again, because I think this is important when you just have a series of steps so people can understand that no matter what the environment is out there, you can actually prosper.
You know, this is really a telling case, and I use this illustration because it's very important, because when people think of fear of a market crash, you think of what happened in 2007 to 2009 when the government was bailing out the banks, they were bailing out AIG, Merrill Lynch, firms were consolidated. Every single Monday, Hank Paulson got on the television and announced some new bailout kind of program. The Fed was printing money, guaranteeing, backstopping everything. I mean, it was about as bad as you can get, thinking back to the Great Depression. But let's assume that that was the case. And let's say you came in with, I don't know, let's just make it easy for illustration, just say $1 million. And you came in on January 1st of 2008. Of that portfolio, you put 50% of it in bonds because you needed a certain level of secure income. You put 40% in stocks, and you put 10% in cash for safety and emergency reasons. Well, by March 9th of 2009, your bond portfolio of $500,000 would have gained 10%, or it would have been up roughly about $50,000. The 40% in blue chip dividend paying stocks would have been down 30%, so you would have lost $120,000 in market value against $50,000 in gains in your bond portfolio. Of course, the cash was break even. So in the worst crisis since the financial depression, your portfolio was down 7%. However, if you had the laddered bond portfolio, your income didn't change. Every 6 months, your bonds paid their income coupon to you. That never changed. During the financial crisis, your dividends from your stock portfolio didn't change. In fact, in 2008, most dividend-paying blue-chip aristocrats raised their dividend in 2008, and they raised them again in 2009. I often tell the story of Coca-Cola, because during the crisis, in 2008, Coca-Cola raised its dividend 8%. In 2009, Coca-Cola raised its dividend another 8%. So in the two crisis years, your income actually went up 16% on Coca-Cola. Now, the stock price went down. Let's say, had you bought Coca-Cola in January of 2008, it would have been roughly about $31 a share. At the bottom of the crisis, it got down to $20 a share. So you were lost about $10 a share. Your income would have gone up 16%. And by the end of 2009, Coca-Cola was back to where you paid for it. So if you didn't do anything, you went on a extended vacation in your motorhome for 2 years, your income went up 16% during those two crisis years. So the reason they call them a dividend aristocrats is they have a long history of raising those dividends. They play a very, very important role. Every study that we've looked at surviving retirement, not worrying about outliving your assets. I don't care if you take a look at the study that Wade Fowle has done and others like him have documented, dividend paying stocks, which he's a big proponent of, play a very important role for those very reasons, for increasing income and inflation hedge, because you better have something like that in your portfolio if you tend to live long and don't want to outlive your assets.
So once again, you've met your basic living expenses and your fun money, or what you call freedom money. Now, what about gift or dream money? Does it have separate sources? Where does it come from?
It can come from a number of places. Let's say if you have excess assets, you have more than enough assets to provide safety, your freedom money, travel, and each year you have surplus income. You can use some of that income to make gifts to grandchildren, to help other people, to gifts to charity. It also could be income growth over time. A lot of individuals that start with blue chip portfolios, when they begin to retire, their income may be up 3, 4, 5 fold over a 15, 20 year period as a result of dividend increases. Others may be finally tapping into their retirement plans. For example, if you rolled over your 401k into an IRA rollover and you've been allowing it to accumulate because you haven't needed it, well, at age 70 and a half, you have to start tapping into it. That may be an additional source of income. Maybe you don't need it, and you can use that for making gifts. Generally, this comes out of surplus income. I have a number of clients have done this, for example, with charitable remainder trust. I have one client, very wealthy enough to have a private foundation designed to foster giving. But it can also be as simple as just giving a few extra dollars away out of surplus income, as you'll see in today's case study with Bill and Jan Smith, who made annual gifts to 529 plans for their two grandchildren.
Yeah, and so everybody understands that's listening today, what we wanted to do was to demonstrate that you can design a worry-free retirement. I mean, the important point is that you have a plan that provides you with secure income to cover your living expenses, income for fun things, but also a portfolio that can protect you against inflation. And everybody's case is a little different, which is one of the reasons we do case studies. There are no magic formulas or one investment procedure that actually accomplishes everything you want to do. But when you have a plan, you can apply the principles of what we've just discussed to your particular own income needs so that they will be met and you will have the flexibility to plan for life's unexpected surprises. Now, as we always do on the program, speaking of case studies, we have a case study which is based on a real life case study with which we are directly acquainted, but we change the names to protect the privacy of the individuals who are involved.
Yeah, this is a case study. I probably have discussed this case study probably in the last, I think we talked about this last year, but we'll call this the case study of Bill and Jan Smith. Bill was age 66 when he retired. He retired basically in 2006, had about $800,000 in his 401k program. They rolled over into an IRA, which went into the stock market. You got to remember what was going on in 2006. Real estate was going up double digits. Stock market was going up double digits. Of course, in the background, Alan Greenspan and then Bernanke were raising interest rates, and we know what followed. Jan, his wife, 58, getting ready to retire, and basically she was still working when Bill first retired. The problem is her salary was $80,000, and it was going to be reduced when she retired. So there were two issues here, Jan's eventual retirement and also the difference in age. Bill had a heart issue in his physical capabilities. He had a heart attack, was taking medication for it, was controlling it, his cholesterol. But there was an 8-year difference between them. longevity running in Jan's family, not in Bill's. And Bill already had a heart condition, so there was the age difference, there was the health difference. Now, Bill's Social Security was roughly about $1,450 a month. That was roughly a little over $17,400. However, at Jan's retirement, based on the years of service with the school system, she would get 66% of her $80,000 salary. As long as she was working, there was almost enough income coming in from Social Security and her salary, as well as some interest that they were earning on their investments. However, at retirement, Bill would have $17,400. Jan's pension would be $54,120. Their income would be $71,520 against an annual budget of $105,000. So there would be a shortfall of $33,480 that would have to be provided through some form of assets. Now, one of the things that we do, and remember Maslow's hierarchy, we talk about getting to that pyramid of security or freedom income, or what we call survival income. So when we got down to their basic budget, and we were going to change this over time, the essential budget was roughly about $90,000 a year. The must-haves, mainly travel, and most of their travel, they had done a lot of travel because of Bill's work. They'd been to Europe. They'd been around the world. So a lot of their travel was seeing friends and mainly contained the United States. But they were spending roughly about $10,000 a year on travel. And then the want-to-haves were $5,000, the $2,500 apiece, to each one of their grandchildren in a 529 plan used for their college education. So the total budget was $105,000 against roughly about $71,000 worth of income. So we had two things that we had to deal with. So, but before we get to that, let's talk about their assets. They roughly had a home in Escondido, roughly about $450,000. It was basically a condominium on a golf course or a townhome. Bill's IRA, as a result of the financial crisis, he had lost over $150,000. It was down to $650,000. It was mainly in money market funds. Jan had a 403B plan. That's equivalent of a 401K plan in the educational system. It was about $300,000. And they had roughly about $40,000 in savings. So they had roughly $990,000 of investment assets. Total assets were about $1,004,000. Against that, they had liabilities of about $300,000 on a mortgage. So their net worth was $1.14 million.
Okay, so as you mentioned, everybody has a different situation, and you're trying to make that work with what you call your Maslow financial hierarchy. What were the issues they were dealing with, and then how did it fit?
Well, a number of issues. Number one, as I pointed out, was the age difference between Bill and Jan, and especially with longevity in Jan's family. So there was already an 8-year difference in age. Secondly, was Bill's cardiovascular disease, and I pointed out Jan's age and longevity. So there was a worry, especially on Jan's part, given their age difference, of outliving the assets. And then we also had to deal with Bill's market fears. I mean, when he retired, rolled his money over, he had $800,000. He put it in the stock market. The stock market was going up double digits every year. And then, bam, the financial crisis. And all of a sudden, those gains in the market were given back, plus additional losses. So Bill had some market fears. Now, one of the things that we did is we tried to break down that budget and say, all right, here's what the essentials were going to be. That was the $90,000 we talked about. So really, $90,000 was the must number that we wanted to meet, and they wanted assurances, especially Jan, given her age and longevity. She wanted to be sure that she didn't live long enough to outlive the assets. So we discussed various things, and one of the things I explained to Bill, we'll try to design as much as we can to take care of the basic budget, but a couple of things. You're going to have some money in blue chip stocks, because otherwise you're not going to have an inflation hedge. And at that time, when we did this plan, interest rates had already come down. We were already involved in financial repression or ZERP policies. Bill was getting hardly anything on his bank CDs and on his money market funds. So what we did to meet the basic, what we call survival money, we put about $500,000 of his IRA in a fixed income portfolio of bonds at 4%, and the remainder, $150,000, in dividend-paying blue-chip stocks. Now, what we did, and we did something somewhat unique, is that we took Jan's 403b plan and we used $230,000 of it, and we bought a single life immediate annuity with a 10-year certain. And what that meant is it would pay an income stream for 10 years if Jan was to predecease or pass away prior to the 10-year period, but we based it on Jan's life rather than Bill's life. If we did a joint life, unfortunately, given joint life, there would have been less money. And so what that did is produced $24,000, or basically $2,000 a month, and made up for the loss in Jan's salary as a result of retirement. And then finally, we took the balance and put that roughly about $70,000 of the remainder into blue chip stocks. So the result was, with the annuity, the laddered bond portfolio, and the stocks, we now had an annual income of roughly $50,600. $20,000 was fixed coming from a bond portfolio, which was predictable, and $24,000 coming from an insurance company guaranteed. So we had $44,000 to go up against that $90,000 fixed need. The result was we now had $122,000 worth of annual income versus a budget of $105,000. So we not only met their travel needs, we met the gift needs, but we also had a surplus, which, you know, basically they could do whatever they want. They could make gifts, increase the gifts, or provide an inflation hedge. We also did one more thing, and this was very important to Jan. Jan did not want to live the community that they lived in. I mean, they were right on a golf course. Their friends were there at the club. She saw herself staying in that house. So what we did is we refinanced the house to a 15-year mortgage, roughly at 3%. So in 15 years, roughly when Jan was in her mid-70s, she would live in a free and clear house. And so as a result of bringing the interest rates down, as a result of refinancing, we used the savings and interest rate to accelerate the pay down of principal through a 15-year mortgage. By the way, I forgot to mention they already had long-term care insurance, but we handled inflation and health care through dividend growth investments. Jan would have a free and clear house, which would free up additional money at age 74 with a 15-year mortgage. We got rid of the market fears through a laddered bond portfolio and the loss of income from Jan's pension as a result of turning part of that 403b plan into an immediate annuity to make up the difference in her income.
And as we say here, we almost sound like a serial radio show from back in the 40s. Once again, another successful rescue of a budget plan for retirement. But it does work. Anyway, coming up next on the program, Paul Horn, Certified Financial Planner with PFS Group, cash flow and the importance of a healthy cash flow in your retirement period as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
One of the biggest issues in retirement, as we just previously discussed, is having a secure source of income. Well, what does that really boil down to? It boils down to what we do in investment analysis. It's all about cash flow. Joining us on the program is Paul Horn, a certified financial planner at PFS Group. And Paul, when we analyze stocks in our business, you always hear analysts talk about free cash flow or the cash that's available to invest. Doesn't the same apply when it comes to retirement planning? Because really, you're looking for income, whether it's a pension, Social Security, or it's income from your investments.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. With the cash flow, it's often one of the most overlooked areas of financial planning, unfortunately, but it is critical to someone's retirement plan. It really impacts how they can save for retirement during their accumulation years and dictates when and how they're going to be able to retire during their distribution years. This is why with financial planning, we start with a budget and a personal balance sheet. The plan starts where you are at, which is represented by that balance sheet, and helps us identify how you can get there over time through the asset growth of your investments and additional contributions you make from your cash flow.
In terms of, however, converting that into actual income in retirement, for example, I may have certain assets. I may also have things that, let's say, can supplement that. For example, for many people in the private sector, it's Social Security. For many people that work in the public sector, it's a pension. So I guess the key is how to utilize both of those effectively to assure for a long-term stability of income that you don't outlive. Let's talk for a minute about the budget, because to me, one of the key things in retirement planning is breaking your budget down into three categories. Things that you know that you have to have, you know, that's paying your bills, your utilities, your food. It could be rent. It could be a house payment, whatever that is. But it's the things that you spend day to day to live. That's one part of your budget. The second part of your budget is the kind of fun stuff, the things you like to do. Maybe you want to play golf, join a country club. You want to do travel. You have hobbies. And then the third is kind of like what I call the wish list. Gee, I'd like to get a motorhome. I'd like to get a new sailboat or motor yacht. Or maybe it's even things like making bequests or gifts. So, Paul, let's talk about not just the budget, but the important components of a budget, because don't cash flows have to be married to certain parts of the budget? Because if you know that, for example, you're spending $5,000 a month, $4,000 of that is an essential part of your budget, you really want to target that $4,000.
Correct. Yeah. When we look at the budget, we look at what I would call needs or wants. Your needs are oftentimes your fixed expenses, your things like your mortgage, your rent that you have to pay to live each month. And then we also want to look at your wants, which is your entertainment spending, your free time, what you like to do, your hobbies, whatever that may be. And the goal when we're looking at budgeting is trying to keep those fixed expenses low and monitoring those variable expenses. For a lot of people, the biggest detriment to their budget is those variable expenses. They may not realize how going to Starbucks every day, buying a $4 latte, how that adds up to $120 over the course of a month. And doing that multiple times or many things like that can really create a big hole real quick. So when we do the budget, we want to first try and keep those fixed expenses a little bit lower. And then we want to continue to monitor those variable expenses ongoing. And with the budget, the best way to monitor that is to control at the end of the month, compare what you planned on spending versus what you actually spent. Because what that's going to allow you to do is really determine those areas of opportunity for additional savings.
Now, what about also another way of looking at that budget? Let's say you take your basic budget, which is, you know, what it costs me to live, the fun part, and maybe the wish list. What about targeting inflation? Because we do know, I mean, I can just think looking back at the year 2000, what I'm spending on utilities and food today. I'm spending as much on food today as when I had all three of my children at home. What about inflation? Because we know in retirement today, one of the issues is longevity. People are living longer today than they did, let's say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, which means you have a greater chance of outliving your assets if you haven't provided for increased cost of living.
Absolutely. And so with the budget, we want to try and maintain some flexibility for that. So ideally, you don't want to be living off 100% of your budget each month. That will help provide some cushion over time. And ideally, too, with people's salaries, hopefully we're able to maintain that cash flow over time by salaries increasing, ideally. If it's not, then that needs to be reflected in the budget and making those adjustments to account for inflation.
So when you take a look at these three different components of a budget and you think of your portfolio or your cash flow needs, let's talk about this concept of buckets versus, let's say, diversification. You may have one bucket that could consist of maybe Social Security, pension, could be bonds, it could be annuity. But the purpose of that bucket is to take care of, let's say, your primary living expenses. You may have another bucket that provides for, let's say, emergency or flexibility needs, and another bucket that takes care of the wish list and inflation. Explain how that is much different than, let's say, what I call these standard cookie cutter approaches that say that, hey, you're 65, that means 65% in bonds, 35% in stocks. Talk about, in contrast, the, let's say, bucket approach to fulfilling specific needs versus just a overall percentage in terms of where you put your assets.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a huge proponent of using what I call the three-bucket approach for savings and wealth accumulation. Really, the first bucket is the one that you talked about, and that is the most important, being the emergency fund. That's going to be, ideally, at minimum, 6 months worth of living expenses, plus any other money that's set aside for short-term goals. So, for example, if you know you're going to be doing a home remodel for $20,000 in the next 10 months, you want to keep that money in an emergency fund, which is just going to be cash, because we don't want it exposed to market risk. That is the first and most important bucket. From there, then, we want to look at the third bucket, which is the inflation bucket, and that's going to be retirement-specific accounts. So there's accounts that are tax-advantaged for retirement savings, like a 401k, 403b, or Roth IRAs. Retirement is the most expensive thing a person pays for in their lifetime, so we want to make sure that we're putting the majority of our cash flow each month into that bucket. And then finally, the second bucket is what I would call the wealth accumulation bucket. This is going to be for goals that are not retirement specific. So examples would be buying a second home, paying for kids' college, things like that. The advantage to this bucket as well is if it is used for retirement, what it can do is help diversify your taxes in retirement. Because in this bucket, this is going to be a regular taxable account or trust account. So we're able to take advantage of tax advantages like long-term capital gains, as well as qualified dividends, which are taxed at a lower tax rate than those retirement accounts, which are subject to ordinary income taxes.
So what is the advantage, Paul, of taking a bucket approach versus, let's say, the standard traditional method of taking care of retirement planning? Okay, you might have been in the accumulation phase where you were more invested in growth stocks. You retire and they say, okay, they take your age and you're retired and they give you a percentage of how much you should have in bonds and stocks.
Yeah, the challenge is we're experiencing right now with the financial repression. These traditional rules are kind of getting thrown out the window. The 4% withdrawal rate, the taking your 100 minus your age to get the amount that you should have in bonds, things like that are changing. The advantage here to the bucket approach is it provides a simplified way to handle your finances, but it still provides for diversification of your portfolio assets because you have your money diversified in terms of time horizon, as well as can be spread across different asset classes, which is going to help with the proper asset allocation. One of the advantages too with this approach is most people tend to be top heavy in their retirement savings, where they have the bulk of their assets in 401ks and IRAs. So being able to put money in cash and in that second bucket, again, that goes back to the tax diversification, can help them from a tax perspective when they enter retirement.
So, Paul, as you take a look and contrast this approach, let's also talk about some of the issues that come up in retirement. We can have, I call them personal black swans. All of a sudden, somebody has a stroke, you have a child. Today, we see divorces, we see children that need help, they move back home. It could be, as many boomers experienced in the last decade, we saw two bear markets. So let's talk about those black swan events, and let's relate that to something that's called the Monte Carlo simulation and its purpose in preparing a plan, because really what you're trying to do is stress test your ability to really not outlive your assets.
Yeah, absolutely. When we develop a financial plan for clients, what we look at heavily is that Monte Carlo simulation, where we are trying to stress test and identify the biggest concerns related to someone's individual financial plan. So when we use the Monte Carlo simulation, we're running thousands of different simulations, adjusting for different rates of return, different inflation rates, things like that, trying to identify the biggest gaps or concerns that might be. And if we have one of those major life-changing events, like a child returning home, having to take care of an elder, whatever the case may be, at that point, we definitely need to update the financial plan because that's going to have huge implications on someone's overall cash flow.
So when you look at these unexpected events and then also the fact that we know that, for example, everything that we're looking at in the market today, I mean, if we're looking at where interest rates are today, I'm sure that somebody that retired in the year 2000 would never think that they would see a time where interest rates would be as low as they were in Japan for an extended period of time. So let's talk about These are the kind of things that you have to prepare for, because no plan is static, and we know things will change over, let's say, a 20, 25-year retirement period.
Yeah, absolutely. No one can predict what's going to happen with market returns, legislation. Those are the type of risks that we have to adjust for and account for over time. The plan is really designed to serve as a roadmap for clients, sort of like the navigation in someone's car. You have a starting point, which is where you're at today, and then the plan is designed to help get you to your retirement goals over time. And of course, we may have to take detours along the way based on changes to cash flow, changes to legislation, taxes, whatever the case may be.
So in summing up, just as if, let's say, I'm a portfolio manager, I'm analyzing companies, looking at their balance sheet, how strong they are financially, the amount of debt that they have, but I'm also looking at what the cash flow is for the company, because I know, what does that cash flow mean? It means the company has the wherewithal to, let's say, expand, build new plant and equipment. They have the cash to increase dividends or buy back their stock. It's the same thing that applies in retirement. And isn't that really the key to long-term success, is a growing stream of cash flows throughout your retirement?
Absolutely. Cash flow is really where we begin and end with the financial plan. That's going to help us determine if someone's in their accumulation years, how much they're going to be able to save each year, and help determine the different types of buckets or accounts that we should be saving in. Then when someone's in retirement, that cash flow is going to dictate the lifestyle that they're going to be able to live and when and how they're going to be able to retire. So just like evaluating a stock for a company, cash flow is imperative when you're evaluating a person's financial picture.
So in summing this up, when you work on a financial plan, what are the key components that you look at, and what's the most important kind of feedback that you can get from a client?
Yeah, absolutely. So the place that we always start when I'm looking at a financial plan is going to be a person's personal balance sheet and cash flow statement, which is going to be someone's budget and someone's income. When we're looking at the financial plan, then what we will do is stress test it using the Monte Carlo simulation to help identify other concerns to someone's financial plan. A very good and recent example is a business owner where they had the majority of the income, 80% of the income for the family came from the husband. And just doing some basic stress testing, we were able to identify that if something happens to his income, their cash flow is significantly reduced below their living expenses, and their chance of success on the Monte Carlo simulation went from 85% to 31%.
And how would you correct for something like that? I suspect if you don't have those assets and you're dependent on one person for a source of income, I suspect traditionally, at least in financial planning, we've used insurance to make up the difference for assets that weren't there or something to replace a person's income.
That is absolutely correct, Jim. In this case here, we had to look at some form of insurance through disability insurance to help cover that shortfall in the cash flow. We use insurance when someone can't afford to pay for the costs associated with that, or they don't want to bear the risks associated with that event.
Well, listen, Paul, if our listeners would like to find out more information about financial planning with you, how could they do so, please?
If you'd like to learn more about doing a financial plan, you can contact me directly at 888-486-3939.
All right, Paul. Well, listen, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best to you, sir, and come back and talk to us again.
Thank you for having me.
You know, Jim, in listening to you and Paul talking there, one of the things that becomes really obvious to me is that as we've done these shows over the years, there is a solution to almost any problem. The real trick is overcoming what I call the panic reflex and actually sitting down and working out the plan, and then you can figure out which direction to go.
Yeah, it's amazing, John, because the statistics we keep reporting here on the program, there's a number of studies out there. But one of the key things that have come out of these studies is not just the fact that we're living longer, but it's the fact that people don't have a plan. And as a result of that, they don't know where you're going. I mean, think about it, folks. If you were leaving on a road trip, let's say you were driving to a vacation destination during the summer, The first thing you'd do is probably you'd have GPS in your car. You would have a map. You would know exactly the points that you were going to go, the stops that you were going to make. It's the same thing with our personal finances. Corporations have budgets. They have balance sheets. They have cash flow statements. They analyze things. They take a look at where their budget is, where their sources of income, their profitability. It's no different for us personally. So hopefully, as you can see, there's more than a number of ways you can reach your financial goals. The most important thing is start out with a plan. Well, in the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.